It's a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks are striking 13. Hello, and welcome to this week's Big Mouth, the talk show for people whose music, books, film, and TV habits are just about under control. I'm Andrew Harrison, and today we'll be looking at Gorillaz. Damon Albarn and Jamie Hewlett's cartoon band are back with their fifth album, Humans. The duo first conceived of a virtual band drawn by Deadline comics artist Hewlett back in 1998, making Gorillaz almost 20 years old, and probably bigger than Blur. They've got a lot more serious as the years have gone by, as Albarn and Hewlett have fallen out and reconciled, and the world has become more horribly serious around them. What do we make of the return of the cartoon band when most pop stars are now like cartoons anyway? We'll also be listening to the 11th album by Blondie, now 43 years in the game. Pollinator features songs written and co-written by Johnny Marr, Dev Hines, Sia, Charlie XCX and Dave Sitek of TV on the Radio. Is it still Blondie if Debbie Harry and Chris Stein only wrote three or four songs? And can you still pull off angular post-punk when you're 71 years old? Plus, as ever, we'll be playing our guests' favourite songs of the moment, in which case we better say hello to them. Travis Elborough is a writer and broadcaster with a close affinity to the London subconscious. His books include The Bus We Loved, London's Affair with the AEC Routemaster, and A Walk in the Park about park life. He's also written The Long Player Goodbye, the album from vinyl to iPod and back again, and the script for St. Etienne's brilliant London documentary, How We Used to Live, one of the best evocations of the capital's past life you could ever see. Hello, Travis. Welcome to Big Mouth. How are you?
Pleasure. Very good.
Yes. Jolly good. So How We Used to Live is this kind of amazing, evocative thing like the London that nobody knows, the sort of classic London movies. Is that what you were going for? Is that the feel you were after?
No, definitely. Yeah, we wanted that slightly mysterious, misty-eyed version of London, a London that doesn't exist anymore. And it's narrated by Ian McShane, so it had a certain antique Lovejoy quality about it.
Yes, too. Well, going to say, but what's it like having Ian McShane speak your actual words? Did you expect him to keep saying Miss Grace Jones, Slave to the Rhythm, and things like that?
We hoped, yeah, obviously. that's what we were longing for.
Mr.
He was
Pete
great.
Wiggs.
Unfortunately, we didn't get to meet him. He was recording Hercules or filming Hercules in Hungary or some obscure, cheaper Eastern European country that's obviously used for film work now. So we sort of did a down the line. But no, it was wonderful. I mean, and he was actually very enthusiastic about the script. We felt we got some stuff right. You know, he said, you know, I used to have the action cookbook by Len Dayton. So, you know, we had elements of the script that seemed to fit him and his personality.
Fantastic. Now, and I also mentioned you wrote The Long Player Goodbye. Did you have to hastily revise it when vinyl came
back? Even at the time, we wondered whether it should have had a question mark rather than a statement. The vinyl revival at that point was quite nascent, and actually at the time it seemed to be more about 7-inch singles. It's again, that's coming on for 10 years old now. It told the story of vinyl. I mean, it just started with the premise, you know, what happened when vinyl arrived? How did it change how we listened to and bought and, you know, consumed music more generally, and how artists responded to all this stuff. I think it still works.
Where do you stand on people calling them vinyls?
I'm not happy. It's plural, isn't it? It's plural.
Yeah, it is. It's not a vinyl. It's not a noun. Yeah. Also making their Big Mouth debut today. That was the sound of somebody making their Big Mouth debut. Also making their Big Mouth debut today is music business lady about town and it girl of Britpop, Polly Birkbeck. A King's Road layabout during the punk wars, she mistakenly ended up in music PR, where during the golden years of the 1990s, she handled Suede, Pulp, Elastica, The Auteurs, and the Britpop glitterati. Now she looks after Paul Weller, Joan Jett, Goldie Looking Chain, and The Beat, featuring Rankin Roger, amongst others. But she remains a punk girl at heart. Welcome to Big Mouth, Polly. How are you?
I'm all right, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. That was the sound of Polly being welcome to Big Mouth. So you were at the nerve centre of Britpop when you worked for Savage and Best. You did PR for all those bands. What are your happiest memories of this period?
Do you want to know my happiest memory?
Go on.
When I did press for Menswear.
Really? Why was that your happiest
memory? Because it was great fun. Got to travel all over the place. I went to Japan, America several times. And believe it or not, no one slagged them off while they were on their high, and they never got slagged off. Everyone enjoyed talking to them and photographing them, and it was great, great fun.
They were
really quite
a likable bunch, weren't they?
They were.
It's one of those sort of...
They looked great. They were young. You know, what's not to like then? I mean, it was very zeitgeisty.
The music,
obviously.
Possibly, but, you know,
we
can't hold that against them.
Maybe it'll stand the test of time now, but it was just great fun back then.
There is definitely an inverse relationship sometimes between the niceness of the people and the quality of the music. You know, usually...
People wrote nice things about the music then. Your magazine even put them on the front
cover,
Andrew.
Well, my magazine, Slack magazine, we put them on the cover. Admittedly, I was on the way out the door.
What
a
great front cover it was.
It was beautiful. They
the
had little
indie
devil.
Take that, the, I believe the headline was.
Yes, and they had little devil horns on, that kind of thing.
And now, there is a case, isn't there, for saying that Menswear are the most successful bands.
Yes, actually,
yeah.
All the individual members have gone on to do
really good.
So let's go through them. So obviously, Matt Everett's on the radio.
Yeah.
Chris and Simon are managers, and I think Simon manages, you know, Grammy Award nominated, winning Phoenix, and I can't think who else he managed, but they managed some quite sort of hit bands, and he's based in America now, I believe.
Yeah. So, yeah, Men's were most successful band in Britpop.
Well, half of them, maybe.
Now, I've noticed that you've been documenting your Kings Road punk years on Instagram, and particularly your collection of one-inch badges, and there was one particularly good one. Jonathan King is fantastic.
My dad had loads. He's a real junk shopper. You know, he used to go to junk shops and buy loads of crap, and my sister found that in a big box of badges. Jonathan King is fantastic badge. I don't think they'd make that these days.
No, probably wouldn't. Do we know where it came from? Was it a Walton Hop job?
Probably from a jumble sale or something.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. It's probably from when he was quite a successful pop artist, wasn't it? So it's just...
Yeah,
the button badge for Jonathan King.
I don't think we make enough of the one-inch badge because it's really more important than the seven-inch single, isn't it? Really, even at the age of 50, I still like to wear a one-inch badge.
I've still got most of my badge collection from my youth.
Did you get them from Better Badges?
They used to have a Better Badges store that often have them at gigs, like at the Lyceum and Hammersmith Palais. Yes, I used to buy them there. I used to send off them. They used to have a little mail order thing I used to send off.
They used to have a chart
them.
As well, didn't they? There was a Better Badges chart.
Yes, the back of the NME,
But Kingston books. Anyone who knows Kingston from the 80s, books, bits and bobs, sadly now a Tesco Metro, was the place to buy T-shirts and badges and patches.
Patches,
like
yeah.
Patches, yes. You could sew your madness patch on the back of your red Harrington.
I've got a denim patch.
Things like that.
For denim, back in denim somewhere. And I've had it for 20 years and I've been waiting for the right thing to sew it onto. And,
I've got one of those. I think I've got a denim plectrum as well. I've even got a denim long sleeve T-shirt with the glitter band on it saying,
wow,
hey, it's denim. Better dig that out for eBay some point.
Absolutely. Well, get your eBay searches sorted out, listeners and viewers. Also with us, as ever, the man who ensures that every syllable of Big Mouth is painstakingly preserved for future generations' audio pleasure. It is the Mick Glossop of podcasts, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Do you keep all your ephemera and your concert tickets and your badges and stuff?
I don't. And I'm kind of, hearing Polly talk, I'm kind of thinking, oh, man, there used to be a shop. When I spent my teenage years in Bristol, there was a shop called Forever People, which was the Bristolian version of kind of Forbidden Planet, and they had a big kind of like 6 foot by 3 foot piece of foam or pinning stuff on beside the door with loads of different badges on it, and they had the fantastic Ian Dury four-part series of sex and drugs and rock and roll badge, which was filled up a whole lapel and also got you a detention at school, which was quite good.
That is, because the beauty of the one-inch badge was it could fit on the lapel of a blazer and possibly on the inside if you need to just quickly flash it without getting a detention.
But I do remember when they first came out and the punk thing first happened, that there was the guys in the sixth form who kind of didn't quite get it, and they used to have massive badges.
Oh, we used to call them dustbin lids.
Yeah. Which were kind of with wire pink flag, the whole of the album cover on it, and it was kind of like,
I don't know whether do you remember the very brief heyday of the 3/4-inch badge and 17 3/4-inch badge?
Just had a pin on.
Yeah,
I had a Killing Joke one.
I lost it
straight away.
Yeah, well, they were very easy to lose.
They didn't stay on very well.
But I went to see Adam Ant last year, rather brilliantly, because I had all them originally. They had all of the kind of slightly saucy black and white
Xerox and Perv Mag.
All the Perv Mag stuff, which was really brilliant. I was tempted to buy them for old time's sake, but I thought, been there and done that.
We should just talk about badges all day. Let's not. Let's move on. Let's get rolling with our first album of the day, the aforementioned Humans by Gorillaz. It's their fifth album and the first since 2010. It features guest appearances by Grace Jones, Jenny Beth from Savages, Sausages, Danny Brown, Benjamin Clementine, Mavis Staples and the inevitable De La Soul. Albarn has said the record is an emotional response to politics and that one key inspiration for this album is Simple Minds. What do we make of all of that? We'll talk about it after this taster from Humans. This is Andromeda. Gorillaz with Andromeda from the new album Humans. The album opens with the words, "I turned my robot off and now I know more but retain less." It's basically drop your smartphone in the toilet, kids. So, Polly, you were saying, I'm not hearing Simple Minds in there.
I'm certainly not hearing any Sons and Fascination or Chelsea Girl or I Travel going on there. What you mean is a bit of an electro thing.
Yeah, do you think it was more of a philosophical inspiration rather than
philosophical? I don't know.
I'd like to see Damon in like sort of white panstick makeup doing shapes. Mm. you know, doing
I don't see the Simple Minds in it. No. I couldn't listen to it that many times because my computer thing didn't like the download thing that I had to use.
Oh, well, there's the irony.
It's the robots. Yeah, an
album saying, give technology the swerve, everybody, it's controlling our minds, wouldn't play on your technology. I like to hear that. No. Yeah. Travis, what did you make of Humans by Gorillaz?
Well, they're becoming almost as good as Slade at bad spelling, aren't they? Adding a kind of Z. There's a Moments, there's a Robots. There isn't a track called Killers with a Z, but I almost willed there to be one.
Do you think, right, I hope you've done the dishes with a Z on the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because I almost feel, Ben Mendelsohn, the Star Wars actor, appears as a kind of narrator throughout the album. And suddenly being made aware of that fact, it dawned on me, really, that Gorillaz has become sort of Damon Albarn's Star Wars franchise.
Yeah.
Essentially it gets revived every so often. Some new people are kind of brought in to continue the mothership on its way, and some older figures, more established, Grace Jones as Cary Grant, are kind of brought in to add that kind of luster of its composition. It's a kind of mothership of thing, isn't it? As far as just a kind of a juggernaut of guests and so on. The last track for me, We've Got the Power, is an amazing piece of work, though, it has to be said.
Yeah.
A kind of pounding, almost kind of anthemic thing with some lovely string work on it and guest vocals from Jenny Beth from Savages. And Savages are not a band.
Sausages.
Yeah, yeah. Savages are not a band I particularly like. I mean, they are essentially Susan the Banshees shorn of all the pop sensibilities, and those were the best bits of Susan the Banshees.
Polly's nodding vigorously here.
But I think, if the Labour Party had any teeth, they would adopt this as their campaign song. Here we have an Anglo-British number featuring Noel Gallagher, so an arch rival that's been brought back into the fold. Yeah. The metaphors and the song itself
and a French
are all there.
Person.
Exactly. Anglo-French combination. So.
Yeah, was Noel Gallagher on that track?
Well, apparently he was, and then he was amputated in a race because it wasn't quite working. But
I like that track. It's quite cheerful, seeing that she's quite a misery cut.
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, Gorillaz is always... you mentioned that it's a franchise. Gorillaz to me was always like, this is Damon hiding in a big crowd, so he doesn't have to be the front man anymore. And the other key thing, obviously, is there was a massive, massive singles band, and there are singles on this, but I think it's a denser and harder bit of work than it's not Sean Ryder and De La Soul is it?
I think his Marley stuff and all that's for the grown-ups, for the olds, and this is for the youth, and I think it will go down really well with sort of teenagers and stuff. But I looked up all the people on it. I'd never heard of most of the featurings. I looked them all up, and they're sort of quite obscure.
I think that this is what he does.
Some of them didn't even have a Wikipedia page. Oh my god!
I was actually in Marley with Damon for that first Marley trip, and we were talking about, and he was saying, he wouldn't tell me what it was, but he was saying, there's this thing that I'm doing which is going to be mad if it comes off. And it
he's
was the first
clever.
Gorillaz
he's such
thing
a, he's a
and
very
it was
clever boy.
Yeah, and obviously we all know where that went, but I think it's turned into a little bit of a... Yes, there's hiding in plain sight, and yes, there's the kind of mothership. It's also a bit of a Damon going, I'm such a tastemaker. Here are all these people. Aren't I cool? And which... There's that with kind of... people who've been big on their scenes like Popcorn and Vince Staples and Pusha T. And then there's also kind of, De La Soul, Mavis Staples. It kind of felt to me like... He rang all these people up for features, and they kind of all got back to him. And so they went.
By a few big names.
He got knocked back by Morrissey, and I would love to hear Morrissey.
That would be interesting.
But can you imagine Morrissey in amongst a load of hip hop stuff and reggae things, and all the things he hates?
But it does strike me that everybody who said yes is on this record.
Yeah. But why would you say no? I mean, because they are.
No. Totally.
Fun
but,
and interesting
but that gives it a kind of a very, I think, kind of quite fractured and disparate kind of feeling all the way through.
His plaintive vocals pop up on every single track, so you don't forget whose album it is.
Well, yeah, but I think the one that I liked best was the track in the middle, "Busted and Blue," which was actually just him, a very kind of almost like a ballad, and it was just that's really nice just to hear him sing rather than being kind of pushed and pulled and just having to do a little kind of featured vocal.
I think even he adds the melody, doesn't he? That's the vocal thing. And again, Andromeda, I think, particularly has that slightly Bowie soul inflection that is another kind of obviously key touchstone for him.
It's funny that you mentioned Bowie, because I think if Damon Albarn had just continued his career under his name, if he'd been Damon Albarn from day one, we would consider him to be the contemporary David Bowie. He's gone through phase after phase after phase, constantly reinvented himself. Well, because he does a bit of it as Gorillaz, a bit of it as The Good, the Bad and the Queen, a bit of it as himself, a bit of it as Blur. It's like all these things are treated as side projects to Blur, and I just wonder if it's time to start thinking of Blur, lovely though they are, as basically a side project to Gorillaz, because, you know, I think what he's taken 18 months, he and Hewlett and various producers have taken 18 months to, and probably longer, to make this Gorillaz album. The last Blur album, they made it in a week, and it was treated as the thing. This is the actual totemic statement. I mean, Polly, you know, you were forever holding Damon's pint in the good old days and the good mix. Did you ever think he had this kind of thing in him?
Back then, when he was about 12, God, who knows? I didn't know what the future would bring in styles of music or anything like that, and he'd be such a, you know, amazing sort of magpie. So he was just a little pop boy then.
I mean, Britpop could be very prescriptive, couldn't it? It was like, you were allowed to do this and you're not allowed to do that.
Actually, he never had a particular taste in music. He didn't really like much. He was influenced by people like Justine. I mean, it was Graham that was the big record collection person, whereas Damon just... All I remember him saying he liked was Julian Cope.
But he'd been in a synth pop duo, I think, had he not, when he was at Sixth Form or Auburn. Because there's a famous picture of him with some bald bloke that looks like a Jedi from Howard Jones.
Throwing off his mental chains, yes.
So Cope's in, I mean, because they didn't Lovell produce one of the later albums, so I'd work with...
Steve Lovell, yeah.
Yeah, he'd worked with them.
They even had a song, didn't they? Pressure on Julian.
Yeah. And actually, there are large chunks of Modern Life is Rubbish that are straight out of Teardrop Explodes, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed it, but I do think they are better when it's just all out straight down the line pop, when you get a Dare or a Clint Eastwood or that kind of thing, rather than this stuff that has to be unpicked, I suppose. If you'd said 20 years ago that, the guy that's fronting this Britpop band would be doing, such a huge variety of different things, and he'd be making musicals, and he'd do a very kind of low-key solo album, and, we would have been amazed and stunned.
Part of Life was quite an eclectic album, if we think back
to it.
What's the face from Stereolab doing some sort of chanson on it. You had the Cod Syd Barrett number by Mr. Cheese, bass playing man, whose name floated away from my brain.
I wish that I could forget.
Yeah. There's out and out disco, Alex, and there's kind of drone. And
yeah, so, so, and I think, you know, the, I can remember the people were quite, maybe just be nostalgic, but when Modern Life is Rubbish came out, people were quite taken aback by this. Suddenly, right, we're going to be the Kinks angle at that time, when really what seemed to be in the ether was shoegaze and dance music, to sort of go back to basics in that kind of way. And that phrase, unfortunately, was probably around at that time due to the major government. But, a bit of politics, sorry.
Well, Humans by Gorillaz is available now for streaming and even buying in a record shop if you do old-fashioned things like that. Let's move on and have some music in a different vein. Every week we ask our guests to bring in their favourite tune of the minute, whether it's old or new, whatever they fancy, an editor's recommendation. Polly Birkbeck, what have you brought for us?
Well, I went to see The Pretenders the other week at the Albert Hall, and I thought they were fantastic. I thought she was amazing. She's 66 this year, Chrissie Hynde. Her voice was fantastic. She was doing all these... bants with the drummer, the one that didn't die, and she was funny. And her last single, New Stuff, I thought was fantastic. So the single Alone by The Pretenders, I used to hear on the radio and think, what's this?
Here we are. It's The Pretenders and Alone. Alone by The Pretenders, as chosen by our guest Polly Birkbeck. And Polly and Travis are both rhapsodising about how fantastic The Pretenders were while it was playing, and how good she was live, and how underrated The Pretenders are.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to stick in a similar vein of post-punk power pop with Blondie and their 11th album, Pollinator. Since reuniting in 1997, they've now been going longer than they were first time around, I think. Deborah Harry, as we should call her, is accompanied by founder members Chris Stein and Clem Burke, while relations with former first teamers Nigel Harrison and Frank Infante remain acrimonious. Blondie have not always tried to reinvent their own personal wheel since returning, although the Ghost of Download album from 2013 was a bit of a weird excursion into electronics. Nevertheless, they have a sound, and it's their sound. Is Pollinator the bee's knees, or will our guests deliver a waspish verdict? Let's find out after this. Blondie with Long Time. That was Blondie with Long Time from the new album Pollinator, and Travis was playing air drums in the Clem Burke shuffling style, a proper Blondie sample. That was actually co-written by Debbie Harry and Dev Hines of Blood Orange. Polly Birkbeck, this is your vintage. Were you a Blondie fan?
Oh, of course I was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was she your hero and role model?
Oh, Debbie, the most beautiful woman who's ever lived, will never be beaten. She's wonderful. I love her.
And yeah, you know, sort of when Blondie starts to push out of doing straight up no wave kind of thing and do heretical things like rap and disco, the actual punks hated it, didn't they? They got furious about it.
I don't know, actually. I thought Rapture was fantastic. I thought The Tide Is High was crap, though. Mm.
What did you make of this album?
I actually really liked it. It was good, but it's another thing like Gorillaz, isn't it? Get loads of guests and co-writes and all sorts of things. It's very the thing to do. But I remember listening to one of the tracks thinking, this sounds like Joan Jett. It was Joan Jett. You know, she's on there.
You're her
well.
PR. You're supposed to know
I
about
know,
these things.
I know, on that track.
Joan, what have you been doing?
I was happy. I listened to it a lot, actually. It was good background music. I mean, I don't think I would buy it if I still book records.
You don't have to. You're in the music business, Polly. You get records for free. If you don't notice this.
But I thought it was really good. I was pleasantly surprised. And nearly most of the tracks were really upbeat and, you know, catchy and all those sort of cliches.
Travis, is it possible to approach records like this without it being sort of, you're kind of thinking about the history in the past rather than think about the thing in and of itself?
It is tricky, I have to say. I mean, and also starting your album with a track called Doom or Destiny.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a height of fortune, isn't it? You know,
yes.
It's like, you know, well, either this is going to be a disaster or this is what we're supposed to do. I mean, and, you know, there are lyrics like in Long Time, it's, you know, racing down the Bowery. The word heart turns up quite a lot. There's a thing about, you know, clear as a pane of glass. So
it's a reference to Radiate.
Yeah.
As well.
So there's quite a lot of familiar tropes and territories and the palette, as Polly's rightly said, you know, operates the sort of great Blondie thing, which is really to be perhaps more Bee Gees than CBGBs. And you certainly get that on that track.
You've thought about that quite hard, haven't you? That's a very good one. I like that, yeah.
Well, I mean, Clem Burke himself actually always tipped his hat at wanting the Bee Gees drum sound. So, I mean, I think there's an element where anyone who's a Blondie fan is not going to be disappointed by this record to an extent. But what I would say is a lot of the tracks seem a little long. They tip over into that 4.5 minute thing. And just to have a look, I kind of dug out my copy of Plastic Letters and Parallel Lines and stuff. And most of the stuff on that gets over within, you know, in under 3 minutes or 3.5 at the max.
Yeah.
And I think it just, I wonder whether or not you would willingly choose this over all the classics.
Yeah.
And there's nothing on here that is quite of the height. I mean, I
that's
think
quite a big ask, though, isn't it?
Of course it is. But I think even Fun, which is probably the catchiest on it and the most pop beast of a song, you still feel a little. It sounds like Blondie.
Yeah,
and sounds like is in the end what I think the whole album is a bit like. I mean, it's interesting thinking comparing it with Gorillaz, thinking back to the 90s and that, you know, new wave, and how most of those bands had a kind of Blondie track. That arpeggiated bass thing that you get, and all those, and the disco bit, and the new wave guitars, which are always those things that sound like a car passing, don't they? It's just a kind of that thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone would be. Interestingly, I think it's a completely ridiculous thing to say, but you know, if this had come out in the 90s, it would have been they've really really captured that kind of palette.
They really sound like themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas now it just sounds like them, but we're just a bit jaded by that idea, because in a way also that way that how we listen to music means that the past can be as present as the present anyway.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, I think.
And also, you can only have an exciting comeback once, can't you?
Yeah.
I mean, my only issues with it were that I felt like the production was a bit crammed. It was a bit sort of tinny and overstuffed, whereas the great thing about those early Blondie records is, although they're very sleek, they're not overstuffed. You can hear everything, and it's all in place, and it's brutal discipline and brutal simplicity.
I always think about Blondie. They had a number one in the 70s, number one in the 80s, and number one in the 90s. So their career's been pretty good.
A bit like Cliff.
I knew you'd mention Cliff when I said that.
Don't knock Cliff.
But yeah. If it does mean that the channel, the BBC 4 get to rerun that fantastic documentary on them where they all kind of get the original band members together. I think it's at the Hall of Fame or something.
Yeah.
Where,
oh, yeah.
Where Nigel's in the corridor and they
frosty?
All walk past.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Very
yeah.
frosty.
You do wonder for the answer, again, what makes bands fall out so badly, don't you? You know, it's a personal abrasion.
Well, to be fair, there
money.
Was...
Money.
And heroin.
Yeah.
Yeah, that,
money and heroin. Yeah. Yeah. But apart from money and heroin... What's the problem here?
Chris Stein's had some recent exhibitions of his photographs.
Yeah,
they're very good.
And they're really amazing.
Really good, yeah.
And there's one particular one that, when I was listening, so I was thinking about it again, about contrast of time and all the rest of it, which is there's a photograph of Clem Burke wearing his Beatles-esque gear. He's got his black skinny jacket, skinny tie on, with Debbie Harry walking down a street in Manhattan. And all around them are 70s people in denim with kind of long hair. And they look like aliens. They look like they're on a mission from God or something. They're Blues Brothers types that just kind of appeared in the midst of 70s New York to save it from all of this hairy denimness.
Yeah.
And I think that was important in Blondie back in the day, that they were an antidote to something. The problem with them now is they're not really an antidote to anything.
Well, it's hard to be an antidote to anything
exactly.
at all now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, change of pace time. Let's have another editor's recommendation from one of our guests, Travis Elborough. What music have you brought in for us?
I've bought the Pattern Forms, which is a band comprising two guys called Ed from the Friendly Fires and John Brooks of the Advisory Circle. And they are on the Ghostbox label, who have a sort of fantastic roster of stuff that sounds like a weird mix between Noi and the Radiophonic Workshop.
That was The Pattern Forms with Daylight, as chosen by one of our guests, Travis Elborough. Now, let's go somewhere else, with someone else. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, the latest Marvel blockbuster, is out this week. An offbeat mix of space opera, bro-style comedy and 70s rock made an unexpected hit out of Volume 1 in 2014. It became the ninth biggest grossing of some 40-odd Marvel movies, making global stars out of Chris Pratt and a bunch of characters like Groot, Gamora and Rocket Raccoon that, previously, only nerds like me had ever heard of. Does Volume 2 hit the spot, or has that offbeat mix curdled into formula? We'll see after this tune from the soundtrack. The gag, of course, is the Pratt's character Peter Quill, left Earth as a kid with only cassettes of 70s rock to remind him of home. And who wouldn't be happy to get lost in space with The Sweet and Fox on the Run? That was, of course, The Sweet and Fox on the Run from the soundtrack, the awesome mix to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Well, I went to see it with our geek culture special correspondent, Michael Moran, writer for The Times, The Guardian and The Jewish Chronicle, and general internet man about town. Hello, Michael. How are you today?
How do you do? I'm fine. Thanks for asking.
Have you come down from space, yes?
I'm still quite elated, yes.
Quite elated and quite transported. Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Volume 1 was an outside bet for Marvel. Volume 2 has a lot riding on it. Does it deliver for the general viewer as well as massive nerds like me and you?
I think it delivers principally for the general viewer. I think that whereas there are some really kind of ostentatiously niche shout-outs,
yes,
they're all contained in the, I think it's 47 after credit sequences. Each one is like the layers of the sort of circles of hell as you get deeper and deeper into geek culture with every single one.
Now, set up the main movie for us. What exactly is happening here?
What is happening here is the Guardians are a loose family, a cabal, an elite, if you will, of like ragtag adventurers who have been contracted to defend some batteries from a kind of Lovecraftian beast.
This is actual batteries in the Duracell sense, not in the sense
exactly
of weaponry
right.
batteries. Yes.
No. They're I believe they're PP3s. Lick 'em and you'll know all about it.
So it does from this sort of opening sequence where we see you get the whole of the Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm. Laid out, don't you? Because it's an amazing opening battle with a multi-tentacled beast. But in the foreground is little Twig Groot, the tree creature.
Living his best life.
Who was destroyed at the end of the first one and comes back as a twig because he's growing up to
tree
size. And he's just in the foreground for this whole scene to the sound of Mr. Blue Sky by ELO.
Yeah, it's joyous.
It is joyous. It's the whole joy of Guardians of the Galaxy in one very an amazingly, ridiculously choreographed piece of effects and acting and so forth. Mm. But when story intrudes, story involves the arrival of Kurt Russell as a character called Ego.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're a Marvel nerd, you know exactly how the film's going to play out immediately you hear his name.
Ego, the living planet.
spoilers. And he, we discover what his relationship is to Chris Pratt's Peter Quill. What did we make of Kurt Russell?
Well, the thing is about the casting of Kurt Russell is, and this is the one thing I have against this film, is it's quite heavy on the knowing winks.
One big knowing wink, isn't
it? They did so well, I think, with the first one that they have, and I don't mean this, I came away loving this film and keen to see it again. I'm going to be seeing it about the time you're listening to this. It's great, but there is an awful lot of, we've arrived now, guys. And the whole kind of, there's a swagger to it that is sometimes a little bit ostentatious.
Yeah.
And Kurt Russell is one of the knowing winks. It's one of the kind of 80s pop culture references which abound in this film.
Yeah.
And some of them are brilliant and funny. And some of them are just a little too on the nose for me.
Yes. It's very on the nose. I mean, it's interesting that Peter Quill, I can't call him Star-Lord because it's such a... I mean, even by my corny Marvel standards, it's a really corny name, Star-Lord. Anyway, Peter Quill, it's interesting that he gets, at the beginning of the movie, what he's always been looking for his whole life, rather than it being the end game of the quest. And then we sort of investigate that and find out what it really, really means. Mm. I suppose... You mentioned that they're a family, and they are misfits. There's there's Gamora. She's green, and her dad is Thanos, the Mad God. Drax the Destroyer, who's completely emotionally illiterate, a talking raccoon. It makes Modern Family look very much like the 1950s picket fence family. One of the things that the movie is, I think, gets a little bit laborious is it sags in the middle because we spend such a lot of time discovering what everybody's personal issues are.
Yeah.
When in fact you are in a spectacle movie, you're in a movie that's about exploding planets and crashing spaceships, and I get that. I think what invests the whole Guardians of the Galaxy world with its charm is that despite being effects laden, makeup laden, weird characters, they actually do have an inner life. The downside of it is that it is a bit corny, isn't it? Everybody's individual story is a bit corny.
A little bit. Well, there is one moment that I did think, oh dear, now this is a bit. Just felt a bit phony to me. But then later it becomes clear that that bit was supposed to be phony and there's a perfectly good reason for it being phony.
Yes.
And it made me feel dirty and shabby for being so cynical about the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point because for all of the ludicrous spectacle and we travel, from planet to planet, we see thing after thing destroyed. The charm of it is that fundamentally... these characters are kind of bumbling through the universe, particularly Chris Pratt.
Mm.
And in a weird way, for all of the kind of bro humor and, the references to cassette tapes, ha ha, aren't they funny? Here's a 70s rock song, ha ha, isn't that funny?
Yeah.
More than anything, to me, it's like an American version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's a very crowded universe with a lot of stuff going on. It's not the empty void that we're often presented with in science fiction. This is a busy, busy universe. And these guys are just bumbling around on the margins, getting into trouble out of their own stupidity, actually, out of their own short-sightedness and their own personal failings, rather than a grand plan. And in fact, when you run into the characters who do have grand plans and science fiction motivations, Nebula, for instance, Nebula is what is one of the villains, and she's played by Karen Gillan of Doctor Who fame, Come Along Pond, under so much makeup and prosthesis, it's ludicrous. She has science fiction motivations. She has grand science fiction motivations. And they really fall flat compared to... Chris Pratt just wondering where his dad is and missing his mum.
Yeah.
And, you know, wanting to rattle around the universe listening to, you know, old bits of Aerosmith and Cat Stevens to remind him of home.
Yeah, I mean, the real touchstone, and I'm glad you mentioned Douglas Adams, because that's what it feels like to me. The Guardians of the Galaxy notion is essentially Firefly rewritten by Douglas Adams.
Yeah.
They're quite similar in the sense that they're just kind of like goofing around the universe. Then there's no Death Star to attack. There's nothing like that. They're just goofing around. Stuff happens to them. They don't go around looking for trouble. Well, they kind of do, but only out of bloody-mindedness, not out of a quest.
There's also an interesting kind of story construction aspect to it, which is that it's, in one respect, it's a bit like Finding Nemo. Everybody has to rescue everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, every character is in trouble and has to be rescued by another one. And everybody, even Little Twig Groot, plays his major role.
Mm.
And it's actually quite charming. I think we saw a Fancy Pants advanced screening at the Hammersmith Apollo in London.
Didn't we?
Which they presented as a gig. You know, there was a DJ beforehand playing 70s. I think it was
Merch Stall.
Seb Fontaine, apparently, was the DJ.
All right.
Yeah. And then the cast came on to take a load of cheers like it was a rock show. And it was actually quite charming. There was lasers. Lasers were to be seen. But I sort of wondered whether, you know, that actually might be the future of films like this, because it's not the world's greatest story. It's not the world's most coherent epic that will live on in your mind. But what it is a great big ludicrous experience.
Yeah.
It's both funny and impressive.
And in the same way that, you know, gigs have changed now, they essentially, this was the Guardians of the Galaxy. They came on, they played the hits.
Yeah.
You know, there were deliberate callbacks. There's one quite pivotal scene that I can't talk about in any detail, but it is a visual echo of another almost identical scene in the first one.
Yeah.
Where the outcome is different, but the intent is the same.
Yeah. What are the drawbacks of the film then? I mean, I've got to say, I don't think the female characters, with the possible exception of Gamora, played by Zoe Saldana.
Yeah.
But I don't think the female characters stack up very well at all. There's a terrible new character called Mantis.
Mm.
Obviously, all comics nerds will know she's an ancient character, but she's introduced to the Marvel Universe. And it's I've got to say, it's a terrible Asian stereotype.
Well, I must say, my beef with Mantis is, I mean, I like Gamora and I like Nebula. And one of the reasons I like both of them is that both of them, even though they have special space boots with high heels, they're kind of space high heels, but they're still high heels, they don't go around falling over. They don't need rescuing. In fact, the opposite is true. Gamora is genuinely the rescuer rather than the rescuee. Yeah. But Mantis, she does have sort of soft power, but she's the one that falls over and needs picking up. And it just feels a bit like, guys, you fix this. You fix this problem of, you know, the chick, help me, help me, help me. Yeah. And then you bring it back.
Yeah, I just didn't understand the function of her in the story, because as you'll know, you'll understand very quickly, we're in the presence of infinite power almost. And why does infinite power require a woman with antenna to wander around like the empath in Star Trek Next Generation saying, I sense unhappiness? Well, I sense unhappiness too. I can see it right in front of me. I don't need antenna to... I see someone is angry.
Yeah,
really? They just punched a hole through a spaceship.
But she is also there to tell you all about what's going on.
Yeah.
She's one of two people that tells you rather too much. There are two clanging info dumps.
Yeah.
And she's responsible for one of them.
Yeah. Actually, I think there's probably more than two clanging info dumps, because the screen is so crowded. You've got a core cast of six Guardians of the Galaxy, an additional cast of Peter Quill's old boss stroke, corruptor in chief Yondu, and all of his mates. And then you've got the people that Yondu ran out on. And
the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, it's essentially Pirates of the Caribbean in space. And then you've got the original, the planet Sovereign that we see at the beginning, where the Guardians kind of make a terrible faux pas. So we have to deal with the people from Sovereign. It's a very, very, very crowded
screen.
A lot
happens.
Consequently, to me, the character development, there's not a lot of room for nuance here. There's not a lot of room for, two or three minutes of smolder where we start to understand what the relationship is, say, between the sisters, Nebula and Gamora. People have to literally come out and say it.
Yeah.
You know, you never cared for me enough, because there's going to be an exploding spaceship or a monster along in a minute. So it does produce the character story, a character line can be a bit corny, I think. And yet at the end, for all of the corniness, I found myself rather moved at the end. Did I see you had a bit of something in your eye at the end, Michael?
No. It was just like the smoke and the lasers was bothering me.
There was a lot of smoke in that room, but I think there was a little, you know, again, not to ruin it.
There are some genuinely touching moments. There is one thing that happens that is just, I would like to talk about, but I'm not going to.
Yeah.
It relates to the visual echo from the first film, and it's both delightful and brilliant and sad.
Yeah. Do you think that, director James Gunn's fondness for undercutting either the schmaltz when we're getting a little bit too character-y and perhaps the superhero boy fans might be going, feelings, or the portentousness when people are delivering space speeches, his fondness for undercutting it with a bit of 70s cheese or a gag or just a bit of grossness, does that feel a little stagey sometimes?
It feels to me like he's worried about the age of his audience and, you know, there's always a kind of, hang on a minute, we've gone 3 minutes without pleasing the 8-year-old boys.
Yeah.
Let's get back to those guys. Let's blow something up. Let's have a weird creature like stamped on. Although there are scenes of mass slaughter in this film, which I wouldn't necessarily, what is this, a 12 or 15?
Yeah. So I think it's a 12 actually.
But there is this feeling, this Saturday morning cartoon feeling of, right, okay, we need an action beat now. We haven't had one in about 3 minutes. Let's get back to some adventure. You know, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that the Guardians become separated. And one of them, you know, one set goes on quite a ruminative, thoughtful journey. And the other set just get into some hijinks and trouble. And there's a big fight. So we can cut every time that the thoughtful guys get a bit too thoughtful or weepy. Boom, we go back to the comedy guys having a massive fight.
So Guardians of the Galaxy and Deadpool, and to an extent Ant-Man, kind of opened up this new area for Marvel of kind of you can do comedy, you can do hijinks, and you can do humor and flawed characters in a way that DC just isn't doing. Mm. The reason Batman and Superman is so incredibly flat is they have no sides to them, they have no humor, they have no inner life, and the absurdity of the superhero world is never addressed the way it is in Marvel. Where else can they take this? Because the stakes are now so high for Marvel as a studio.
Well, the thing is, yes, Marvel are the game to beat. I think that what Marvel did very cleverly, in phase one, they built a universe. They just built one that we all believe, that we all invest in. So in phase two, they can now fool around in that, they're playing in that sandbox they've created so that there was a buddy cop movie in Iron Man 3, and there was this kind of, I'm not even sure what it is a kind of Pirates of the Caribbean movie, this new Guardians of the Galaxy one.
Yeah.
And they can just drop other genres into this superhero sandbox.
Yeah.
And it all plays out. It all works.
The second Captain America movie was essentially kind of a political thriller, wasn't it? It was like the Manchurian Candidate or something like that, except with a guy in a superhero outfit.
So now, they could continue to just say, right, what have we not done? We could, they've had a heist movie. They've had, as you say, a political thriller that was a bit like 3 Days of the Condor. They've done this, they've done this kind of space comedy that is really, it's a pirate film.
Mm.
I don't know what they're going to do next. They've kind of touched on a love story, but they might do another one. They can do what they like.
Yeah.
And I think we'll carry on. I think they're safe at least up until the big climactic pair of Avengers movies that are coming.
Yeah. Well, it's not 47, it's only five post-credit sequences. Yeah. But there's one element in there, a Marvel nerd Easter egg that had me exploding, and I'm not going to say what it's about, but I think when you spot it, if you spot it, you'll be very happy. So Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is out now in cinemas, I believe. Michael Moran, thank you for joining us. Please
thank
come back
you very
to
much
Big
for
Mouth
inviting
soon.
Me.
See you again soon.
Cheerio.
Okay, let's do a quick one on something we couldn't fit in an earlier episode when it came out. Hip-hop soul star Kendrick Lamar played a real dirty trick by surprise releasing his fourth album, Damn, on Good Friday, meaning that all of our music journalist friends had their bank holidays ruined. Matt Hall is tremendously excited about this, and Joe Muggs put together the obligatory hot take for The Guardian. We're going to have a quick look at it after this from the album. This is Humble.
Nobody pray for me. It been a day for me. Yeah. I remember syrup sandwiches and crime allowances. Vanessa nickel with some counterfeits, but now I'm counting this. Parmesan where my accountant lives, in fact I'm down in this. Douce with my boo babe tastes like Kool-Aid for the analyst. Girl, I can buy your Westie girl with my base stuff. Ooh, that pussy good, won't you sit it on my taste buds? I can't wait.
Kendrick Lamar with Humble from the album Damn. Matt and Joe, explain to us quickly why this is such a big deal.
Kendrick is the Jesus Christ of hip-hop.
Oh, right, okay.
Don't oversell
it. So that's why it came out at Easter, right? Yes.
Yes, of course it is. I mean, you know, he is everyone's hope for greatest of all time. Is as a rapper, technically, he is extraordinary. His choice of musicians, his choice of producers, everything has been exemplary. And he represents this kind of huge, wide open space between gangsterism. He comes from Compton in South Central Los Angeles, and the modern politics of Black Lives Matter. I mean, it's...
And he's doing it, the thing is that as well, he's doing it with a kind of lyricism that has been... the successful rappers haven't been displaying over the last kind of, like, I'd say 3 or 4 years. You know, this whole thing about mumble rap and this idea that kind of guys like Little Yachty don't have to be able to...
Little Yacht?
Little Yachty, yeah.
I said Little Yacht.
Don't have to be able to freestyle and aren't bothered about lyrics and writing. There's a whole load of things that kind of old rapping guys have...
Dad hip hop.
...have been really kind of quite disgruntled.
Yeah, and I mean, Mumble, you know, Young Thug and Lil Yachty represent a completely different style. So it's wonderful stuff in its way, but it's not about... storytelling and lyricism. Yeah. It's a different art form almost, and he represents kind of a return to old school rap lyricism values,
but without the backpacking and
without this old guy worthiness about it. Mm. Or so we think. There is a bit of worthiness on this album, I feel. Funnily enough, I was listening to old Jeru the Damager album, and you know, which I loved at the time, produced by DJ Premier of Gangstar. And this was like the politicised hip-hop of the mid-90s. And my wife came in and went, "Oh, what's all this television drug of the nation nonsense?" And I just like...
Hey, don't knock that. They were great.
Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopocracy, but they were very worthy. And every track was like a harangue. And I've got a little bit of a worry that on this album, Kendrick is feeling pressured into this spokesman role that he's been given.
But I think he's kind of pulled back a lot from the big statements that were To Pimp a Butterfly. You know, they were kind of a lot more obvious, like the discussions with Tupac and the kind of how do you handle fame, and the fact that All Right came out of that with a kind of Black Lives Matter thing. I think this is much more about being slapping, you know, traditional hip-hop tropes of kind of slapping down people who aren't as good as him and saying that he's the realest and the best.
There are some great boasting tracks, it's true. It may be a grower. It's difficult to tell. It's somehow more low-key than To Pimp a Butterfly. I found myself, and I never thought I would say this, missing the skits.
What? Missing 30 seconds of rubbish? Yes.
Yeah, missing the talking and the chat and stuff, which made To Pimp a Butterfly flow so amazingly as an album, actually. It became a big drama. It was like a, you know, rap opera.
Yeah. A rapper, in fact. Do you think are people reviewing the status and the importance rather than the music by now? Is it the kind of thing where people will be terrified to say and it's a point out if it wasn't particularly good?
The weight of expectation hangs heavy on him for sure. But
I think it's a lot. I think what I liked about it was it's a lot more straightforward of a record, a simpler record than you know. There's not the kind of massive changes in kind of the jazz lights, changes in kind of time and structure that there was in To Pimp a Butterfly. And I think it's a lot more kind of linear, traditional album, if you like, than Butterfly was. And I think that's quite a refreshing thing, quite a good thing. I liked it because of its simplicity.
Is it true that one of these tracks is produced on an iPhone, or is this just a myth for Wired magazine? Steve Lacy, one of the producers on this, apparently did it all on an iPhone.
It's entirely possible. I mean, you could. Mm. You absolutely could. I mean, an iPhone contains more processing power than the biggest studio computers of 15, 20 years ago, so why not?
Yeah. I mean, coming to this with a completely blank brain, this is totally not my thing. I mean, I was kind of... It was the production that hooked me, and the spaciousness and the strangeness and the... and yet this is more of a low-key thing, less dramatically strange than To Pimp a Butterfly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been... working with all kinds of this. There's this whole Los Angeles-based cosmic hip-hop, jazz, psychedelia influence scene. Flying Lotus is the leader of it. When we talked about David Axelrod on the podcast a while back, you know, I mentioned this kind of Californian cosmic, and he is very, very plugged into that. And To Pimp a Butterfly had a huge amount of Thundercat. Thundercat is the
who it transpires just get makes all these woozy sounds by being very, very drunk most of the time.
Yeah, the bass player. I haven't seen the credits for this album actually, so but it sounds like he's all over it. It sounds like there's a lot of the same personnel as on the last album, and it's got a lot of very spacey, processed, kind of floaty Hammond organ chords and jazz fusion bass playing and stuff. And yeah, it's not Noodle. I mean, it's not self-indulgent soloing at all. It's all about the groove still.
And that's our show for the week. Thanks to our multitudes of guests this time. Travis Elborough, author of A Walk in the Park and The Long Player Goodbye, the album from vinyl to iPod and back again. Thanks to Polly Birkbeck, the Zelig of Britpop, plus our roving correspondents Michael Moran and Joe Muggs. Remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our archive shows at audioboom.com/channel/BigMouth, or you can go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store where you can subscribe. You can find Big Mouth there. Just click on the subscribe tab and you will get the podcast direct to your iPhone or your other unbranded device, possibly even a Zune, automatically. You'll get it sent around about Saturday lunchtime, we think, so you can put it on a loop and you won't have to listen to election broadcasts all day long like everybody else has to. That's enough from us. Matt and I will be back again next week with another Big Mouth. Until then, England prevails.